Welcome to Security Squad. This is a CertSecurity.com podcast. This is part two of two, and a look back at 2010. This episode was recorded on December 13th, 2010. Joining me today in the studio is Eric Perizzo. Eric is senior site editor of CertSecurity.com. Also in the studio is Mike Momoso. Mike is editorial director of the Security Media Group here at Tech. We also have a special guest for this episode. Pete Lindstrom is joining us on the phone. Pete is a security expert and industry analyst. He is currently research director for Spire Security. Let's move on. Microsoft decided to go to a district court in Eastern Virginia, and it got a judge to cut off over 270 domain names believed to be controlling the Wallodak botnet. They crippled this botnet. It seems like this was a success for Microsoft.
Oh, sure, definitely. Microsoft deserves a lot of credit, I think, as we've discussed before, for sort of developing and acting on this multi-pronged model. We're, you know, talking about technology, putting technology to bear to stop this, as well as, you know, using the government, using the courts to actually take down the domains, which is great. At the same time, you know, by and large, I think this was a relatively easy win. For Microsoft, because they knew it would be easy to compared to how most botnets operate, you know, using a variety of international servers and domains, you know, this one they could use domestic courts and have success. But I think what was more interesting to me is how Microsoft used this as sort of the introduction to talk about the need for a broader consumer network access control system, and the pros and cons of that are very interesting, but certainly I hope that we'll see more cooperation both domestically and internationally to try to shut down botnets in this way, because certainly it proved effective.
That's right. You're referring to Scott Charney's presentation in which he talked about sort of a network access control mechanism that would be put in place by internet service providers to check people's or quarantine people's machines that ISPs find have malware on them. And you were in favor of this, Eric.
Well, yeah, this was the key point, I think, from Charney's RSA keynote earlier in the year. Granted, it was a lot of theory, a lot of unanswered questions, but Charney made the case that consumers simply cannot protect themselves from the variety of, you know, malware and targeted attacks and spam, phishing, you name it, that exists today. And no matter how good the defenses are, the single point of failure is still the user's ability to understand threats and, you know, implement the right safeguards. So his case was that, you know, it should be taken upon the ISPs or the government or coalitions of vendors and all sorts of organizations to try to put a better system in place for ensuring that, you know, infected systems aren't constantly gaining access to the network, to the internet, essentially, and spreading malware or allowing themselves to be infected over and over again. So I think it's an interesting idea. I think it has a long way to go. But my whole point is, you know, what's going on today simply isn't working. I know all of us have had to disinfect our friends and relatives' computers on numerous occasions, and without fail, it seems like a month or two later, most of them are still having the same problem. So to me, I hope that this at least starts a productive conversation in the industry to try to consider some of these new defensive methods.
Hey, Pete, we hear from privacy advocates all the time, you know, saying that, you know, if ISPs become more proactive in identifying computers using their bandwidth and quarantining them, that, you know, there's some major privacy issues there. Are you a fan of something like that, where the ISPs take more responsibility, I suppose, and actually inspect machines that are using their bandwidth?
Well, I absolutely support ISPs taking more responsibility. In fact, during Howard Schmidt's first reign as cybersecurity czar, when they published the National Strategy to Secure Cyberspace, it was one of the things I thought was lacking was some sort of stronger proposal to work with ISPs in stronger ways. Now, the actual touching of the machines or putting processes on a client, I'm a little sensitive to, and I'm not necessarily opposed to it, but I'd be looking for something more along an opt-in kind of approach there, and leave those folks that opt out to network-based detection techniques where you can assess the likelihood that these systems might be compromised. So ISP involvement, absolutely. And in fact, you know, I think the ISPs have done a reasonably decent job stepping up more and more, providing free anti-malware software, and there is stuff done behind the covers for various things. I think I think my ISP sent out an email to folks that they thought were compromised, and so there are ways around this sort of brute force approach to security, where we're just going to put we're just going to check for these things and block them. If I thought we were 100% all in agreement on what was malware and what wasn't, and that our software was in 100% agreement with us on what was malware and what wasn't, then I would be more likely to support full-fledged ISP software on the desktop. But at this stage, I think there's plenty of room we can do. In fact, with this court action, the only question I have is, why did Microsoft have to go to court to have this done? There is plenty of precedent in the past for the domain name service providers and the ISPs and everyone else kind of on the server side that is taking domain names down and offline and protecting folks when it becomes clear. So I don't know if any of you guys know, but it's curious to me that they would go this route if, and makes me wonder then, was there some sort of question associated with it, and therefore we wanted folks that might not be as computer savvy but err on the side of caution to address it, or if there's a story behind the story that I missed when this first came out. You guys know what I mean by that?
Yeah, my understanding is I thought it was a variety of ISPs, so I think simply because we're talking about nearly 300, I think that made it difficult. Plus, I think there was sort of a PR and process value to this, too. I think Microsoft wanted to obviously get some press for what it was doing and also essentially publicly define the framework for how to take this kind of action in the court. You find a much larger botnet someday. Maybe it's 2,000 domains. Who knows? I think it wanted to show that this can be done, that others in the industry can do it, and it's sort of maybe inviting participation in that process.
Yeah, and I guess my only comment there is that it's, I think, in some respects, admirable that they would go this route, but I certainly would like to make it less cumbersome to do, and I think it has been in the past. I think there've been ways to do it that were fairly straightforward, and so it's intriguing to me. Now, we don't want a wild west in the courts and with ISPs who just have some inkling that there's something gone wrong, and of course we have to tread a little more lightly because of the cloud-based aspect of things and the potential for collateral damage on co-located sites and the like. But
there was some liability issues there too, because one of those domains was actually a legitimate domain. And of course, if you have a business that's using this, and all of a sudden, a court order, and boom, they
disappear.
Right, exactly. I mean, this guy, I think, had to prove himself as legitimate.
And I think that's the place where I think insurance would be great. If the ISP's got a little bit of liability insurance, and I agree that those guys deserves some sort of compensation. It's one of the things I think is a high risk for, like I said, not only ISPs and server-based presences, but cloud computing, is this notion of being caught up in something you weren't a part of. But that happens all the time in the physical world as well, right? People get arrested very frequently, and they're not and they weren't actually perpetrating a crime. So it happens.
Yeah, unfortunately, that at the end of the day, that you know, these bots still resurface somewhere else, because you got plenty of shady ISPs, right, and web hosts that, you know, don't vet their customers or the content as well as they can, and you know, these guys find comfortable homes and comfortable hosts where, you know, they can pop up again. But this definitely was, you know, admirable by Microsoft, and like Eric said, it probably established a, you know, some precedent and a framework on future similar operations. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, I wanted to bring up something that you mentioned, Pete, about kind of the Scott Charney or the Microsoft plan for NAC with the ISPs. And you mentioned
NAP.
You mentioned the opt-in, opt-out thing, where maybe that might be an answer. There are so many little minor things that need to be watched here, because, okay, what if ISPs did offer an opt-in, opt-out plan? To quarantine, you know, if you opted in, you'd get quarantined if they discover something on your system. If you opted out, more than likely, they're going to throttle you down, or you're not going to get the same quality of service as somebody who's opted in.
Well,
right?
Again, we're
so you're going to be forced to be opted.
This is all theory. So clearly, you know, there's a lot of questions to be figured out. But in talking with Charney, I sense that they favor a system where should an initial inspection discover some kind of malware or botnet activity on a consumer machine, there would be a remediation process, and that would have to be made very clear to the user, provide, you know, limited internet access to enable them to either resolve the situation themselves or provide any and all help they need to do that. And I think you know, Microsoft and ISPs, it would be worth their while to do that. Granted, there would be it would be a cost center there, but when you think about the cost savings from network bandwidth issues and just the wide-ranging effects that attacks can have, being able to reduce those things, to me, it kind of makes sense to be a little bit more proactive to try to do that.
Yeah, if I'm an ISP, I'm going to say Microsoft should take up the cost of this, because they're the ones selling the flawed software in the first place.
Well, and I think that's why Microsoft is saying there needs to be government involvement, because if you leave it up to the ISPs and the software vendors, you know, they're going to be pointing the finger at each other, and nothing's ever going to happen.
Right. All right, we're running out of time, and we still have several other things to talk about. One is, and we'll talk about this briefly, the McAfee dat file issue. So they sent out this signature update and blue screened, or didn't blue screen machines, but they were on this cycle where it was like a restart cycle. They just keep shutting down and restarting. I think at one time we actually saw this before, right? I mean, we've at least seen it, the blue screen issue with when Microsoft issues a patch every now and then. Mm-hmm. So this happens, and I guess what's the answer to something like this?
Didn't hurt their sale price, so I don't think it's a big deal. No.
No, well, you know, McAfee actually was praised for their response. It was
They did.
Like a Tylenol response.
Absolutely.
When the whole Tylenol issue took place.
Yeah, some of this is really just a suck it up kind of thing. If we're stuck with malware, it's not like McAfee tried to do this, and certainly it should bring pause to folks at least a little bit to when they're updating their systems to think clearly about how much they want to do that. It throws a wrench in the whole auto update scene, that is unfortunate on the consumer side in particular. Certainly on the for enterprises and other organizations, I don't see that as it shouldn't be that significant, because the larger ones aren't auto updating anyways.
The majority of these organizations that felt the pain from this dat file issue were small and mid-sized businesses.
It's unfortunate, but it's the life we lead. Every once in a while, people are going to make mistakes, and kudos to McAfee for, I thought, handling it fairly well.
Yeah, they relied very heavily on their channel partners to make phone calls and get companies back online, and I think they even bit the bullet and spent a lot of money in compensating channel partners. I talked to a number of channel partners at the McAfee Focus Forum, who were actually pleased with the response. They said they were compensated well, and I talked to some customers that were affected by it, and yeah, they were affected. Some of their machines were affected. They said it was fairly minimal, at least for them.
One thing that's worth noting here is that among the affected organizations, some of them weren't aware what was going on right away and were kind of assumed that they had been attacked or had been victimized by malware in some way, and wasn't until they got their solution providers and McAfee involved that they realized that they were affected by the file issue. So to me, I think it's sort of, again, as another wake-up call, serve to realize the importance of having a incident response plan in place where, it takes time sometimes to figure out exactly what's going on, but if you have a process in place where, you know, the right people get called, the right resources are put in place, you have experts on hand who can help you, then you can figure out what's going on that much faster, and in the event that it is an attack, you can then, you know, put the mitigation efforts in place that much more quickly. So I think that was sort of an important underlying theme here, is that, you know, granted these data file issues are going to happen, they're unavoidable, but sometimes what looks like a minor software glitch and an attack is hard to distinguish.
Let's talk about the security market in general and all of these acquisitions that we saw this year. McAfee, of course, was acquired by Intel this year. I think there's been more than $10 billion in acquisitions. Pete, is this something that you think is kind of cyclical? You know, we're going to see a lot of consolidation from time to time?
Yeah, certainly over the past few years, there's some great buys out there. And I think, you know, we talk about consolidation every few years, I would say, in the security space. And actually, it's almost gratifying to me to have a robust ecosystem that supports that kind of stuff, and we still have it out there. It's not uncommon in the business world, from my perspective. I think the most interesting acquisition was probably McAfee, Intel acquiring McAfee, and the questions that brings up. In fact, it was a subject of a previous podcast of ours, and you know, this question of a hardware vendor getting involved in software, I think, is intriguing. But when you consider the notion that, you know, no one faults Thoma Bravo for, let's see, who they buy, buying SonicWall, even though Thoma Bravo isn't in the security business. They're just a holding company, right? Mm-hmm. And so to the extent that Intel plays an EMC-like role as a holding company, I think it's reasonable to be to see that that acquisition in a positive light as well. HP buying ArcSight is curious because of the overview. I mean, the OpenView ArcSight similarities, and I say that cringingly a little bit. Maybe I'm sure there are plenty of folks who say they're not similar at all. But the idea of being able to manage alerts and put them together in a SOC. I think is of interest there. I don't know. What did you guys think of some of the other acquisitions?
I think it was interesting to see Symantec kind of rev it up again. They seem to go in cycles with this stuff too. But they spent $1.5 billion in the period of what, 2 or 3 weeks, picking up VeriSign and then PGP and Guardian Edge and. You know, but it makes sense on a lot of levels in terms of getting authentication into their portfolio and adding to their data protection capabilities. You know, you made a good point when you see HP picking up ArcSight and Fortify, and you know they have Spy Dynamics as well. You kind of get a little fearful of what happens to these technologies, and you know, if you're a customer of one of these guys, what, you know, does innovation stop? I mean, it's always a question and always a concern and a legitimate one sometimes. I mean, look at IBM and ISS. You hardly ever hear from the ISS guys again. Most of the folks that put that company together are gone anyway from IBM, but it's become a service offering, I would imagine now. And you know, it's interesting to see how it's going to play out with some of these acquisitions from this year.
Yeah, I was just reading about the end of life notice from the Protego Mars stuff from Cisco. Yeah. Not a big acquisition, but you know, this stuff. The bigger companies are always looking for their inroads in security, and it's not clear to me that there's huge money to be made, and you know, in the order of billions of dollars for folks, where you know, folks like HP and Microsoft and Sun and Cisco and Oracle think along those lines. Although they certainly continue to dabble, Cisco most notably, probably over the longer term. Although I don't think they made any significant acquisitions this year. I wonder if there's something to be said in that.
Mike and I had a conversation with RSA's Art Coviello recently, and one of the things he brought up was his prediction several years ago that there would no longer be a security market. And he talked, obviously, EMC buying RSA, McAfee now going to Intel, Symantec somewhat. They have a storage business, don't they?
Sure do.
I think
there's been some interesting innovation this year, and I feel, you know, when you're in the space for a long enough time, you do think you've seen everything. But even the Qualys and Armorize coming out with their cross-site scripting kinds of, and cross-site cross forgery kinds of protection services, I thought was somewhat unique. And you got CleverSafe out there doing some distributed storage, a la some of what Google's doing, to protect things, and I don't know, Valid Edge monitoring IP addresses, and some of these I can't remember the name of the company managing your DNS profiles, your DNS entries for you, to make sure that there's no spoofing going on. Mm-hmm. So there never seems like there's a dearth of innovation on the security front, even though we feel like we've been there and done that, and everything's consolidated to the max here. So I'm pretty certain that I will remain uncertain about a fully consolidated industry or the disappearance of the security market for years to come.
And consumerization.
You know, let's move into the consumerization of IT for a moment, because it kind of goes along with what Pete was just talking about, which is we're seeing a lot of vendors now jumping on board with platforms to protect mobile devices. You know, some people are predicting that 2011 is going to be a big year for mobile security. And Pete, do you think we're repeating many of the mistakes that were made with the desktop when it comes to mobile, or is it just too soon to tell? Are we just going to be putting a security Band-Aid on these mobile devices?
Well, I'm a huge believer in the we've been talking about ubiquitous computing for years, and so this is no surprise. I think we're finally at the point where the mobile devices are legitimate computing devices, always on kinds of devices that we need to evaluate the security for. Yeah. I don't know that we're, I guess in some respects we're always going to be repeating it from a security perspective, because they start off inconsequential and then they go and get themselves consequential. And so it is important to pay attention to these devices finally. I mean, we've been talking about smartphones for a few years now, and I've been a skeptic for quite a while. I think the time is ripe with always-on 3G data plans, the rage, and finally a set of apps that are moving towards mainstream with managing portfolios and finances, and the challenges associated with a single sign-on of an individual as he manages all of his or as she manages all of her devices for keeping track of all the credentials. It's fascinating now that you assume people have computing power coming into an organization. And I actually did a research project earlier this year where It surprised me when I was talking to CISOs. They were working on two projects. One was a Windows 7 upgrade, and the other was consumerization. I'm going, wait a second, how do you? I mean, you know, it's like creating a gold image for something you're not going to have. And clearly the value prop there is going to be in the virtualization of the desktop. And so I think that gives us new opportunities for protection that folks will leverage. The good news about virtualization is that many folks are sensitive to security already. And so the opportunity to build more security in exists. I'm not saying that people are going to accept that requirement when push comes to shove, you know, money talks. So if it's not too expensive and not too burdensome time-wise, I think we have an opportunity here to get even more secure as we as these devices proliferate.
We may not hear about a lot of mobile incidents, but that doesn't mean they're not happening. If a CEO of a Fortune 500 company forgets his BlackBerry in the cab and, like most users do, don't have any kind of passwords or anything like that set on the device, that's a major incident. And a lot of times nobody knows where that device ends up. And you know, if the organization has their systems enabled to do kind of the remote kill option, that's great, but many don't. So I think those sorts of company-specific incidents are happening all the time. And one thing we're seeing as a major theme for the channel in the next 12 months is companies large and small are all realizing that they have this problem where it's increasingly difficult to protect every user and every device and every form factor. So how do they go about solving the problem? There's a technology component, but there's also an education component. There's a policy component. But the long and the short of it is this is kind of a big, complex, ugly problem that's going to continue to rear its head. And I think, no question, it'll be one of the major themes we see going forward among our listeners is how are they going about solving this problem and how are they going to measure success?
Yeah, I think the distinction there, though, especially in the example you used, is it's loss. It's data loss. You lose your BlackBerry. You're not being attacked. You're not being hacked. Maybe that's the tipping point when we see a lot of, like Pete said, RIM-specific attacks or attacks on Android or Apple. And until then, if you've got CEOs leaving their laptop or their iPhone in a cab or forgetting it in a conference room or dropping a USB stick somewhere, it's a little different. That's more of an awareness issue. It's more of, putting some protection on the data or on the device, remote wipe or some kind of encryption on it that or an authentication means that protects it.
Is that in itself the mobile malware theme worth talking about? To me, I think that's probably one of the most overhyped issues out there right now, because how many major mobile malware incidents have we really seen? And, until there's real evidence that mobile malware is a growing problem, then why does it deserve to be on our listeners' radar screens? That's my question.
I don't think it doesn't. I mean, there aren't many examples of it. I think that's why it's more of a data protection issue in terms of securing the device with, strong authentication or some kind of encryption that, in case the device is lost and found by somebody who knows what to do with it, first of all, and, I just found an iPhone. I'm going to wipe it and buy my service running.
The other thing, why do we have to wait for a major catastrophic incident to take place?
Because we're reactive.
And it doesn't necessarily mean malware either. The question of these devices proliferating, and I worry most, I guess, about the some of these apps where you can store your passwords and your account information, and people are a little lazy on the credential side of things. Of course, mobile devices also may be a big boon to security because of some of this out-of-band authentication kinds of things. There's a couple of companies working hard in that arena, whether it's going to be smartphone kinds of things, phone calls or text or who knows what to verify that you are who you say you are. Now it's fair to assume there's a significant enough population of folks that actually have these devices that you can start building markets around it.
One of the biggest misnomers, I think, is that Apple's iTunes store and Google Android, they actually vet all of these applications, and that's just not the case. One expert told me that the only thing they're checking against is whether it violates any of the Apple or the Google guidelines, and they're not checking for security at all. So mobiles, the applications layer seems to be where it's much of the attention is being focused right now from a security perspective.
I do want to echo a little bit of what Eric said, though. You know, I've been a skeptic for a few years, and I think it's worth it definitely should be on the radar for folks now, this question of mobile security. But this is at the risk assessment stage where you have to start considering their impact in the long term in your organization.
Let's move on to the last news story. It took the Obama administration almost a year to get a White House cybersecurity coordinator in place, and they finally did this time last year. So December 2009, Howard Schmidt was chosen by President Obama to take over that post. And Mike, you wrote a lot about the creation of the whole cybersecurity coordinator position. It's been a year. We haven't really heard much from Howard Schmidt, have we?
No, I was going to say that he's been pretty quiet this year, and I think I'm encouraged by that because that probably means he's busy and swamped and crazy over his head with whatever he's trying to put together. And you know, he had a little bit of a public face at RSA. He did a keynote or a town hall kind of session, which was interesting. And he did some early interviews. But since then, he's been pretty much under the radar. And I would take that as a good sign.
Yeah, I haven't heard much from Howard about many of the initiatives. And I would echo Mike's sentiment that hopefully this means the government is getting its own internal act together and continuing to march. That position, you know, is a, in some respects, there can't be a whole lot of expectation for it when you think about the ability for anyone to try to get the government story in line. I don't have high expectations. I think Howard is a great person for the job. He's very sensitive to managing all of the disparate opinions and all. And
he's got that private sector, public sector experience.
But I'm not, you know, even some of the briefest things associated with FISMA changes around metrics and being smarter about providing evidence are worthwhile initiatives. I think it's generally thankless, and he's not going to get a whole lot of credit in the short term, and in the long term, you know, we won't know for 10 years or so whether there was anything to report back on.
Well, that does it for this edition of Security Squad. Be sure to check out our previous podcast by going to our podcast landing page at searchsecurity.com/podcast. And as always, you can get the latest security news and information at our news page by going to searchsecurity.com/news. For Mike Mimoso, Eric Parizeau, and Pete Lindstrom, I'm Rob Westervelt. Have a great day.